I still get asked quite a lot by first-time heli skiers, am I going to have to jump out of the helicopter? And you're like, oh my God, no, please do not jump out of the helicopter.
Like, we have a
People just have
problem if
these.
you're bailing.
Yeah, if you're jumping out of the helicopter, I better have already jumped out of the helicopter.
You better be chasing me.
Yeah, so, because people just have so much more access to media and stuff, I think there's an expectation of what it might be out there. And I think that causes a lot of anxiety in people. And when you're like, no, we're going to do nothing like that. We're going to go do this. A lot of people are like, oh, I'm so relieved. It doesn't have to be this, huge death-defying thing. Like, we're not going to go outrun the avalanches all day long. That's not what we're trying to do out there.
Welcome to All Aspects, a podcast where we explore, discuss, and celebrate adventure culture and outdoor lifestyle. It is our mission to educate, inform, and entertain our fellow adventurers about the inherent risks that surround us every time we go outside to play, and to provide you with the knowledge and tools to help you do the things you love the most in the safest way possible. All Aspects is brought to you by Aspect Abbey. Aspect Abbey is on a mission to save lives by making avalanche safety simple. It is the only app that tells you where the high and low risk zones are for today's avalanche danger. With a suite of built-in tools like forecast verification, slope meter, and gear checklist, Aspect Abbey is the new safety standard for avalanche risk management. Remember, there are dozens of apps that get you into the backcountry, but there's only one that's designed to bring you home, and that's Aspect Abbey. Go to aspectabbey.com to learn more or download the app to start your 30-day free trial. Thank you, Aspect Abbey, for making this show possible, and thank you for listening. All right, let's get to the show.
Welcome back to the All Aspects podcast. We've got a special guest today, my personal hairstylist and brother, who's a internationally certified mountain guide as well, a longtime senior instructor for the AMGA and examiner. He's a mammoth athlete for a long time as well, and he's run multiple heli operations in foreign countries and currently heli guiding up in Canada, just back home for a little stint before he's off to Iceland for the heli season there. And all around jack of all trades, my brother, Steve Banks.
Woo!
Golf clap.
Steve, welcome.
Thank you. Psyched to
hey,
be here.
Can I just jump right into this one for you guys? So
Sure.
You guys went through the mountain guide training together, right?
Yeah, for the most part.
So did you, Steve, get Jeff into the guiding thing, or can you kind of give me the origin story there?
Yeah, sort of. Jeff was busy at college back east, and I was busy dropping out of college in the West and spending more time in the mountains. Jeff came out to visit. I think it was in the summertime, and we had some summer adventures. And I had been exploring more in the backcountry out here in Crested Butte, Colorado, and just doing a lot more skiing out in the mountains, and was fortunate enough to be learning from a Swiss mountain guide who is here in Crested Butte. And it was actually him and another guy here in Crested Butte who started AIRI, the American Institute for Avalanche Research and Education. And so I was fortunate enough to get my early avalanche education from them, kind of as AIRI was being formed and formulated. It wasn't really a super official thing at the time. And through this Swiss mountain guide, Jean Paviard, I also did some other, he was doing guide trainings. They weren't necessarily, sanctioned AMGA courses. But I started doing some guide trainings for him. He introduced me to the AMGA. He was an instructor and examiner at the time. And I thought that sounded pretty cool. So I signed up for a course. I mentioned it to Jeff. For some reason, Jeff thought it was a good idea. So we jumped over to Aspen and did our first ski guide course over there, which was rather eye-opening.
Nice.
I remember, Steve, you said, hey, I was ski coaching, Nordic ski coaching at the time pretty seriously. And I didn't even really know that guiding was really a career. I was pretty naive. And Steve's like, hey, I'm going to go do an AMGA ski guides course over in Aspen. You want to do it with me? And I was like, sure. What's the AMGA and what's the ski guides course? But I'm in. And then we were driving home.
Real ready, fire, aim approach.
Yeah, after 10 days, we had our hair blown back, and we were on the north rim of the Black Canyon in a snowstorm. And I'm a horrible co-pilot. I always fall asleep. And when I woke up from my dreams as we were whipping around these crazy corners over the abyss in the darkness, I was like, this is what I'm going to do with my life. And here's the next 3.5 years plotted out, just like a training program for ski racing. This is how I'm going to train for guiding. And then that's my life.
Did you guys both do AMGA? Like, what's the for the normies like me out there, like, what's the full process to become an AMGA guide?
So the process with the AMGA is, it's evolving right now and changing a little bit. But there's a couple of different entry points. When Jeff and I started, you could enter at whichever discipline you wanted. So if you're a rock climber, you could start with the rock discipline, the alpine discipline, or we were skiers, so we started with the ski courses. That's changed a little bit over the years, and it's evolving now. And then essentially there's for each discipline, there's an introductory level course where you learn kind of the basics. And then there's an advanced level course that also has an examination component. And then there's the final exam, each one. And so the entry level courses tend to be around 10 days. The advanced courses are about 10 days as well. And the exam is anywhere from 8 to 10 days. All told, if you go through all of it, and now there's a lot of offshoot courses as well. There's a week long ice climbing course. There's sort of different pathways that you can go through the AMGA to get the education a little more tailored to what you want. And at the same time, the AMGA has to meet the standards of the IFMGA, the International Federation of Mountain Guide Associations, who kind of sets that standard.
So real quick, Jeff, is that like a pretty natural progression for a lot of AMGA guides that they just then naturally go for the IFMGA?
Boy, I wouldn't say it's super natural that a lot of people do a lot of it. What I see instructing a lot of courses is that the deeper people get in, the more they want to go the distance. In the intro courses, people tend to be like, well, this is what I need to do for the work that I want to do right now. And I'm kind of checking it out to see where it goes. Some people, and I would say in the ski, it's common that people are just focused on the ski discipline. They want to be a ski guide. They're not really climbers. They don't really want to do that. Or there's a lot of rock guides who don't ski, and they're like, I want to be a rock guide, and that's what I want to do.
Gotcha.
So it just depends. It's up to each individual.
And Dave, both of you guys started with skiing?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Dave, you could kind of think of it as getting your education. Like, lots of people finish elementary school, a few less finish high school, a few less go to college, a few less finish college, and then it's less and less for their master's and then their PhD. This is your PhD in mountain guiding. And the time commitment is somewhere between 4 and 10 years for most people to get their full international certification. But that means also about 10 years of building your resume before you can be accepted into the advanced programs, because you need to have climbed 6,000 meter peaks, vertical water ice, taken your pro level avalanche classes, done your woofer, climbed big walls on El Cap or long trad routes and be a 5'11 climber. So you need to be really well-rounded, jack of all trades. So most people are fully committed, focused on being in the mountains, developing their skill set, their movement, their technique, and picking off their prerequisites as they go before they come into the program. Or, they're like, oh, shoot, I haven't done any high altitude mountaineering. I better do an expedition to Denali for all of June or all of July so I can get that experience.
Okay, cool. Nice. So it's like a pilot getting your flight hours. It's like, you gotta
just like, yeah. 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 And then
the course, okay. Well, there's a lot to it.
Yeah. And then you got to pass your courses and exams, which it's a funny kind of stress because we're used to existential stress, like life or death stress in the mountains. Like, oh my God, Serac, avalanches, rockfall, whatever. But there's the social stress that tends to freak out guides way more than the actual real stress. It's that psychological stress of, oh my gosh, I've invested so much time, money, and energy. I really need to pass this course or exam. And it's a pretty traumatic experience for most candidates.
Do you guys, I think Jeff mentioned this at some point, but you guys have to go back and like recertify, or is that only in France, or what's the deal with that?
It's definitely a French thing. Different countries handle it differently. Technically, the AMGA does have a requirement that you are doing continuing professional development, but there is no real script for how that gets done. For me, and it's an interesting thing for a lot of different people and how different people approach it. I feel like for me, because mountain guiding is what I do. So I'm in it, I'm immersed in it all the time. So I'm staying more current that way. And then also teaching and examining for the AMGA is a huge benefit too, because the annual trainings that we do to stay up to speed with new techniques, new things that are evolving, as well as just continually going through the process. And I love to tell my students all the time too, I learn a lot during every course that I teach. Whether it's, you know, somebody from a different region is like, hey, here's a technique that we use where I'm from. I'm like, oh, wow, I haven't seen that before. Or just by the questions that people ask that then force me to think harder about what it is I've been doing and what it is that I know, and see if I can reformulate that in a different way or see if there's a better way to kind of think about it and approach it. So I really value my work for the AMGA for helping to keep me current and on top of my game personally.
Is there a, well, that's kind of like segues into another question I have, and this is for both of you. Either one of you guys can take this. This is pretty much me now just picking two mountain guides' brains, but have you noticed a difference, say, in the time that you guys have been doing this as your career? Have you noticed like a general trend difference in sort of the mentality of the people that you're guiding, say in the last 10 years or 20 years, like has that changed? Like if it hasn't, that's fine. But to me, it seems like there's so much more emphasis on kind of like the psychology of playing in the backcountry now. But like when I first took an AVI course a long time ago, when I was like 19, it was all just like snow science.
Yeah. I'd say that's an interesting one. And I don't know that I've seen necessarily a trend, because client profiles are all over the board from 20 years ago when I started till now. I think now I might be more proficient at being able to sort of read people and maybe deliver them a better experience that's more tailored to what they're looking for. It's just, you know, it's incredibly different whether I'm taking out like, you know, a father and daughter on their first alpine climb, or if I'm taking out a longtime ski client who we've done tons of trips and hut trips and long traverses and ski mountaineering objectives. So it's really hard to say, you know, the sort of the client profile has evolved over time. Although I would say that with social media and, you know, ski movies being such a big thing and stuff, there is, people tend to think that anytime, I guess heli skiing is an interesting one. I still get asked quite a lot by first time heli skiers, am I going to have to jump out of the helicopter? And you're like, oh my God, no, please do not jump out of the helicopter.
You know, like we have a problem if you're bailing.
Yeah. If you're jumping out of the helicopter, I better have already jumped out of the helicopter.
You better be chasing me.
Yeah. So, you know, because people just have so much more access to media and stuff, I think there's an expectation of what it might be out there. And I think that causes a lot of anxiety in people. And when you're like, no, we're going to do nothing like that. You know, we're going to go do this. A lot of people are like, oh, I'm so relieved. It doesn't have to be this, you know, huge death defying thing. Like, we're not going to go out run the avalanches all day long. That's not what we're trying to do out there.
Oh my gosh.
Interesting. Huh?
Hey Dave, I think this is a great line of questioning, to hit Steve up with. Steve, for different groups, for clients, for guide candidates you're teaching or examining, and then for colleagues, what are some of the silliest stuff you've seen? And I'll start off to give you a moment to think, because one of the best things I ever saw was in Chamonix We're up there on the glacier, first day, second day in crampons, it's pre-dawn start, and we're walking across the glacier all roped up. And then I hear on the radio, hey, you got to check out the folks in the middle of the pack. And they had their crampons with the points going upwards into the boot. And they had managed to strap them on securely because we had been walking for like, I don't know, 800 meters, almost a kilometer in the dark. And it gave me a great deal of empathy because it was like, yeah, it was hilarious and funny. But we all make silly, goofy mistakes when we don't know. It's the full-on Dunning-Kruger effect. We don't know what we don't know because no one told us. And I was like, well, that's on us as guides because we didn't show them well enough how to put on their crampons the day before when we were practicing or haven't practiced enough so they could do it early in the morning at altitude in the dark when they're kind of like, whoa, I'm kind of stressed and peeling the onion back. So what's your greatest hits, highlights of funny stuff that that people have done with you in the mountains?
I remember... and this is way back. I was still a new avalanche course instructor. So this must be like, you know, around the turn of the century in the early 2000s, might've even been 2000 or 2001. And, you know, we do our classroom stint, make sure everybody's got all their gear. Everybody's like, yes, yes, yes. I have everything I need. This one guy has alpine boots and I'm like, you got your ski set up and your skins, like everything's dialed. He's like, oh yeah, yeah, everything's good. I'm like, okay. You know, some people just go in their alpine boots. To me, that's not an awesome thing to do, but you know, some people are going to do that. Okay. Yeah. We get out to the trailhead. Everybody's putting their skins on. I'm looking around. I'm like, okay, it looks like everybody's good. We click in, we go to do our beacon check. And he had skins sure enough and just put them right on the bottom of his alpine rig with alpine bindings and clicked right in. It was just going to shuffle his way out to Abbey One Glade. And I was like, oh, that is just not going to work, buddy. I'm sorry.
Actually, Steve, I can tell you, I'm sorry. This is like a one-upper. I saw a guy, a Danish guy. He was in tandem on the same itinerary as my group on the Oat Route. He skied from Chamonix to Zermatt in alpine boots and alpine bindings. Unbelievable.
Just shuffling along?
I mean, he was in agony and he was so physically destroyed. I was concerned that we were going to have to call the chopper while he was skinning up, but he would just not quit. Talk about a crazy Viking. And his friends were always cheering him on at the cold, like an hour behind. And we'd all be laying around eating our lunch in the sun and the beautiful weather. And he's just like, and he was groaning the whole
time. His hammies must be blown out.
6-7 days. I mean, it's that saying,
that's if you've got to be dumb,
you better be tough. And he was tough as nails.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, but all those kinds of experiences have led me down the path of like, never assume, right? Like with our clients, with our students, even with our backcountry partners, we have to go through everything so thoroughly and just not assume that we're all on the same page, or we can't assume that we all know exactly what's going on. And I mean, it still happens all the time, right? You're standing there on top of a slope with your partner and you're like, hey, you know, why don't you go first? And I think we should group up over by that tree. Everybody's like, yeah, yeah, we'll group up by that tree. And then your partner starts skiing down and you're like, wow, they just went right past the tree that I was talking about. And they're way down there by that other tree. Okay. You know, so we just have to be so clear about communication and expectations when we're out there to make sure that we're all firmly on the same page. And that's a lesson that you continue to learn and you're like, okay, maybe I need to learn how to phrase things differently or choose my words more carefully so that people know exactly what it is that I'm talking about. One of the things I sort of semi-jokingly talk about when I'm teaching guide training stuff is that I always say, I want to make sure that I tell everybody about any potential hazards or what they should do, if for no other reason, so that when the bad thing happens or they did it wrong, I can say, hey, I told you there was a cliff there. I told you the snow was going to change or whatever it is. because that way it makes me feel more assured that like I did my part, I informed them, I did everything I could to steer them away from that thing. And then some people just aren't going to get it and they're still going to go there anyway.
So I'm sure you guys have both, I've heard some of Jeff's stories, but you guys have both seen some pretty like ridiculous, funny stuff. Like, have you seen some pretty goofy, I don't know if they're mishaps or just misunderstandings, like amongst when you're doing guide courses compared to like just normies learning Abbey courses and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, that still happens. You know, it's an interesting thing when people get into guide courses, and I always try to think back to where I was when I started doing my guide trainings, and remember that I was out of my depth at times too. Because it's not fair just to be like, oh my God, you're an idiot. Like, there's no way you can be a guide. Like, I was that idiot 20 years ago when I was trying to do stuff too, right? And often the students are just getting so overwhelmed with so much new information. They've maybe been traveling for a while to get to wherever this course is, and they're feeling all this like social pressure to perform, and they just kind of do stupid things. I've climbed up to, on a rock courses, I've climbed up to anchors and been like, oh my God, that's a terrifying anchor. I can't believe you did that. Or seen somebody completely load a belay device incorrectly, even though I know they know how to do it and they've shown they know how to do it. And then they just brain fart and don't do it, and they don't do it right. And that's an important learning lesson for everyone, to make sure that, you have to be double and triple checking yourself all the time. You can't just assume, oh, I've been taught how to do this, or I'm a guide now, so I can do these things great. We all make mistakes and miss things, and our minds wander and go somewhere else. And it's hard to be hyper vigilant all the time. And especially when we're doing something that we're, very accustomed to, or that we feel very comfortable with, it seems like that's when we really kind of screw up stuff,
Last week,
a good buddy of mine who I've been his boss, he's my boss now in one of my jobs. But when we met, he came to Crested Butte to do a level 2 avalanche course. And I had arranged for us to get a snowcat ride up towards Irwin so that we could get it deeper into the backcountry and go further away. And, we got up there, and this is a guide level training, so I'm not like, does everybody have their undies on? Everybody ready to go? I'm not double checking everything. And we get up there, and in the transition from cars to snowcat, he had put his ski boots in the snowbank, and there they sat. And this guy's he's an IFMGA guide now, and a great personal friend of mine, and we work closely together. We teach a lot of courses for special forces and things like that. Dude's on his game, and even back then he was pretty on his game, but there his ski boots were in the snowbank.
So you got up 12,000 feet at summit at the ridge top, and he's like, oh, I better put my ski boots on. It was like, oh no.
It was before, but yeah, like 10-5.
So a couple of years ago, I was teaching a ski guides course for the AMGA in the San Juans. And I think what you were saying, Steve, is like the cognitive fatigue. Like, we only have a certain number of decisions in us a day. And so you want to have checklists to offload and systems and frameworks to help you, so you don't have to use as much brain power. And we were fire hosing the students so much, and the travel was a lot, and conditions were really tricky. So like really difficult pre-route planning and looking at weather forecasting models and stuff. And they forgot the critical piece for their split board bindings, so they could skin, but they couldn't put it together. And she was just tough as nails. And she's like, I'll be fine. And I was like, what do you mean you're going to be? We're going to be skiing 3000 vert at like 35 degrees on the anvil. What are you talking about? And she just did it. And I was like, wow. Okay. That was really impressive. Way to like pull it together. Just use Volley straps to like lock the heel down and ski with the heel fixed on frozen corn to good corn all the way down to the road. I was just like, whoa. Okay.
Nice.
Damn.
Good moves.
Props.
So, this winter was something new for me. I decided to do something radically different, and I took a job with CMH up in Canada. And it's very different for me because I'm used to working with small groups, programs that I put together, operations that I run tend to be on the smaller side. And I was like, yeah, going to go work for the man. Let's see how this goes. And it was super
really,
cool.
Real quick. Can you just tell what CMH is?
You don't know, Dave?
It's not about me, man. It's about the 25 people who listen to this podcast.
But they could all send me a text and ask. CMH is Canadian Mountain Holidays. It's the original pioneer of heli skiing. It's the largest heli ski organization in the world, I think. And they're pretty well known for kind of having their shit together. And I kind of wanted to go see what that was all about. And I was super impressed. I worked with a great team of guides that really, really had it together. The organization in general, like top down, was really setting the bar. And it takes a lot to impress me. Jeff knows that. So I was pretty psyched to be joining the team. But one of the older members of our guide team, he's been around there for a long time. I know him, and you know, he doesn't know me, but I know him as a mentor because he has written papers for ISSW, the International Snow Science Workshop. He's done lots of avalanche research, come up with new techniques that most guide services now are employing on a daily basis. And I was like, holy smokes, I get to work with him. That's awesome. And then we were swapping tails one day, and somebody had messed something up, and it wasn't anything consequential. I think it was something around the lodge or something like that. And he recounted this tale of getting his group together, doing the beacon check, loading into the helicopter, taking off, and looking down and realizing that he was still in his Sorels and not in his ski boots. And he was like, that's what I realized. There's three ways to deal with a problem. One, can I blame it on somebody else? Nope, can't blame that on somebody else. Two, can I make this work anyway? Nope, definitely can't make this work. Okay, number three, I got to own up to my mistake and go back and fix it. We had a good laugh out of that. But the moral of the story was that often in the mountains or in guiding, when things are going sideways, the tendency is to try to push through and make it work. Like Jeff was just talking about, like, oh, I can just knuckle down and make it work. When really the right answer is, wait a minute, well, let's go back to a known point in time here where we can reset, make things right, and then carry forward. And when I think about some of the times when I've had bad times in the mountains, it's usually because I was unwilling to say, oh, let's go back and reset. Instead, I was like, let's just keep pushing forward. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, I think kind of a theme we've talked about a lot on here is just that trying to make something happen when like all the signs are not working out or not pointing in that direction, like that is one of the most likely chances that the real shit is going to start. Like if you keep kind of pursuing that direction, I suppose.
Well, like, Jeff will probably remember this story. This was a long time ago, and
should I be Jeff nervous?
Is this about Jeff?
No, I think it reflects more poorly on me, but maybe Jeff as well. We used to do stupid things like the Grand Traverse race that goes from Crested Butte to Aspen in the middle of the night. I don't know why we did that stuff, but it was cool, I guess. And I remember we had been training for that. And for us, training usually just meant like, it wasn't like it is now where people are like, let's put on our skin suits and go hammer out some vert. We would just go out and, you know, like call it ski three big lines in a day. And that would be our training. And a big storm had come through Crested Butte and it was high danger. And we were like, well, let's go out anyway. It'll just be a training mission and we'll just, you know, stay away from avalanches and stuff. And so we start by going out the Gothic Valley and we decided to do this big tour, go out one valley around this pass and back down the other valley. And we looked at the maps and we identified that there was some avalanche terrain, but hey, you know, we're aspiring guides. We can outsmart this avalanche problem and we'll figure it out when we get there, even though it's high danger. Right. And this was a huge, as I reflect on it, this was a huge learning point for me, at least at the time. So we go out, we left, I don't know when we left, reasonably early in the day. And we encounter this, you know, we had already gone for several hours before now we encounter this first avalanche prone slope that we have to cross. And it was fairly small and quite manageable. And we stood there and had a conversation about it. And we're like, well, what do you think? And we were both like, well, I think we'll probably trigger it, but I think it'll also be very small and it won't be a big deal. Learning point number one came quickly into play. I was like, well, I'll go first. And I trucked out there, and sure enough, I triggered this small slope and the avalanche comes down, and it was a little ankle biter. It's like filling in around my boot top. So I'm kind of like, yeah, okay. Turn my skis downhill and I'm kind of trotting along with it. No big deal. But the critical mistake I had is that since we were training for this race, I had different equipment than my normal backcountry setup. So I had longer ski poles, more like Nordic ski poles with large baskets on it. And I put my hands through the wrist straps, which I never do when I'm skiing an avalanche terrain. But because my mindset was in, we're training for this race that we do kind of in backcountry / Nordic fashion, I put my hands through the ski straps. Well, when the moving snow caught the larger baskets of my ski poles and I couldn't let go of them, it pulled me right down on my face. And it was super slow motion, this small avalanche that I was kind of chuckling about. And all of a sudden I'm pulled down, fully prone, face down in the snow, pointed downhill, got completely buried. And I wasn't buried by much because I could kind of wiggle my head and Jeff could see that snow moving. And so that's how he knew where I was and came over and unburied me. My feet were still buried a couple of feet down, but I couldn't move. I was stuffed in there. You know, even though I was barely covered by snow, if Jeff hadn't dug me out, I surely would have suffocated in it. And, but he pulls me out, digs me out, dusts me off. And we're like, whew, that was funny. Okay. Lesson learned. I'll take my pole straps off. Should we go back? Nah, let's keep going.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And that was like the first, like that probably wasn't even a point that we had identified where we were going to have trouble with the avalanche problem. We were like, oh, well, let's just keep moving.
You're like, we're a third of the way through it. Let's just keep going.
Let's keep going. What else could possibly happen? So we keep on going and it's high danger.
So unstable. It sounded like the laser guns in Star Wars, like pew, pew, like a blaster, because that was like the sound of the collapses. It was so distinct. It was like someone taking a hammer to a guy wire for a telephone pole under tension and going, bam, pew.
What?
It was wild.
All the signs were there, and we were recognizing all the signs and being like, oh, yeah, man, it's super touchy out here, right? But we're avalanche professionals. We can navigate around this, no problem. We'll outsmart the problem.
Not yet. We weren't quite. Nobody was paying me to make decisions, thank God.
You were on your way.
Yeah. Aspiring.
So we continue on further up the valley. And then, Jeff, I can't even remember what mountain it was, but I believe in my mind it's Cinnamon. I'm not entirely sure. We come around the corner and we're starting to get close to the place where we're like, yeah, that's going to be the tricky point that we're going to have to navigate. Like, we're going to have to go through avalanche terrain at this point. And so we're approaching that point. It's starting to feel more ominous. It's deep snow. Travel had been tricky. I already got buried, so that ate up some time. So it's like way later in the day than we expected. And we remotely trigger from very far away this massive avalanche.
Dave, the whole mountain. We were in the valley floor and we were about to have to cross the run out in the flats. And everywhere we went, we were getting that boom. And I just started jumping up and down in one place. And Steve looks at me like I'm some sort of fucking idiot. And then it remotely triggers from me jumping up and down in place from the summit all the way to the valley floor. It was so cool.
And you guys just happened to be totally out of the run out zone.
Yeah. Luckily for us, it was touchy enough that we were able to trigger it from really far away. And so after that thing ran, we were kind of like, okay, I think now we need to readjust and we should probably go back. And so now we got to go back, Which is a good thing, because as I think about it now, Jeff, we were going to have to go through Paradise Divide and cross that slope under Baldy. Like, yeah.
No way. Yeah.
There's no way.
Yeah.
Hopefully we would have recognized that by the time
we got out of there.
Yeah, that was the way out.
Okay.
And that was the slope that we had been like, well, that's the one we're going to have to use our superpowers to navigate around.
So
we turn around and go back.
Paper map. Yeah. And so you got to use a little card reader, like a credit card, but it's translucent plastic. And the lines show you approximately, they line up, the gaps between the lines on the card lines up on the topo map, the USGS topo map. And you guess at about what the slope angle is. And we're like, I think we can keep it like right around 30, 31, 32. In the steep areas, I don't know. It's hard to tell. So it's a totally antiquated system where you're like, I don't really know what we're getting into based on the map, but I think it might go.
And it's
so
like,
that's, it's so like you're just trying to figure out slope angle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. I'm getting a better picture of just how dicey this was.
I have that card reader somewhere around here. I just encountered it in one of my notebooks. It was like, why do I still have this thing?
It's the thing that makes you go cross-eyed looking at it because you're squinting so hard to try to see the relationships. And
so
in my mind,
at this point, we finally go, okay, well, we better turn around. That was like the obvious sign from the heavens. We better get the heck out of here. So we turn around and go back, and we still have to negotiate like these tight little spots where you're in these terrain traps surrounded by avalanche terrain, and it's just continuing to puke snow. So now conditions are worse than when we came through it the first time. Our tracks are pretty much gone. And I remember, Jeff, we're back by the plug getting through there in this tight creek, and we're both just like, oh shit. And I don't know why. I think he made some statement like, well, I'm the older brother, so I guess I'll go first. we're both just like, well, surely we're going to trigger this slope and die. But we made it through. We got back to Gothic. This was, now it's been dark for like hours by the time we get back to the Gothic town site. And we see a light on up on the hillside in one of the cabins. And some of those cabins have phones. And we were like, we should probably go and call and tell people that we're okay. Because we were, I forget if we were supposed to get picked up on the other side or what. Anyway, we're like, you know, hours late. We've been moving in the dark for probably 3 hours at this point. So we go knock on this door. Can we use your phone? And call. And my buddy had actually had gotten worried enough that he was just loading up his snowmobile to come out and start looking for us. And I don't know where the hell he was going to go to look for us anyway.
Dude,
he wouldn't have been able to get anywhere. But as I reflect on that, and this is often, I don't tell the whole entire story, but it's often a point I try to make with people, is that just because you learn more, it doesn't mean that you can outsmart the avalanche problem. Because a lot of people feel like, you know, they take a level one avalanche course and then they go out there and they're still super uncertain. They're like, I don't know, am I making good decisions or not? Can I go ski a bigger line today or not? I really want to go ski these big mountains, but I don't know if I have the skills. Oh, I know, I'll go take a level two course. So they take a level two course and they learn some more stuff. And then they're still like, well, I don't really feel super confident. I don't feel like I know everything. I want to be able to, you know, outrun the dragon. And so then they're like, even though they're not trying to be a ski patroller or a guide or something, maybe they go and take a pro level course thinking that then they'll learn the answers. And it's like, you know what? You're never going to learn the answers. There's just times when you just cannot be an avalanche trainer. You just can't, and you shouldn't be close to it. There's times when you can start to toe that line a little bit, but you also have to start to understand when is the right time to do that. And when is the right time to do that for me is totally different than it is for the right time to do it for Jeff or for you, Dave, or for different people. You see it all the time, especially around here in Crested Butte, where people are sending big lines. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. And it's not because they have more avalanche education than I do. Arguably, they have far less. And it's not because I'm not a good enough skier. And it's not because they're making stupid decisions. It's just that that's where their risk assessment and acceptance of that risk is just different than mine. And so that's always an interesting thing to go about. And it's going to be different even with guides, right? Some guides are going to push a little bit harder. I know guides who, I have clients who don't want to go with them because they feel like that guide pushes too hard. And on the flip side, I know guides that clients don't like to go with because they're like, wow, that guide is like way too conservative for what I want to do. So everybody kind of needs to find their own niche in that. And people ask me all the time, you know, like the difference between skiing in different areas, you know, what's the skiing like in Japan? What's it like in Canada? What's it like in Alaska, Iceland, South America, all these different things. And a lot of it comes down to which operation or guides are you going with and what type of experience is offered. And it's going to match differently with different people. And same with guides as far as like operations that they might want to work with. I've worked for operations where I'm like, the risk tolerance of this ski operation is higher than what I'm comfortable with. And I don't like being pushed that hard. And so I just don't want to work there anymore. I'm going to go someplace that's more conservative or aligns more with how I feel and the team jives better. That was one of the things I really appreciated at CMH is that as a team, you know, I was a new guy to the team. And as the team, it was like everything really jived, like the pace, the risk tolerance, how we liked things to flow throughout the day. I felt like I fit into that quite nicely and it felt comfortable to me. I didn't ever feel like I was being pushed to go faster, to go higher, to go bigger or anything like that. And to me, that's something that's super important, whether it's my ski partners or the operation that I'm working for or the other guides that I'm around. I don't ever want to feel like I'm being pushed to do things that I don't want to do.
To go back a bit, Steve, I think you're talking about risk homeostasis. It's like I'm driving a beat up old Chevy Gremlin, you know, that's like a death trap and driving really
cautious. Or Pinto?
Yeah, Pinto, Gremlin, same. And versus, you know, a Volvo with airbags all around with studded Haka Palita tires. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do 65 in this blizzard because there's nothing coming. Why not? And we often see that where folks are like, why are you here for your level 2 avalanche course? They're like, because I want to send the NAR in Colorado midwinter. And you're like, oh, sorry. You're going to have a short but exciting life.
Yep.
Is that common? Like, I mean, I grew up in Colorado, so I think I have a skewed view on this. But when people are going into Abbey courses, like, is that something you still get a lot? I would just think like at this point, enough people know how dangerous and like how unpredictable it is that there would be less of that. But am I totally off on that?
You know, I sort of think that it's a symptom of the avalanche phenomenon and the uncertainty that we just deal with, right? And so, Dave, what's your avalanche education? What have you done?
I've taken 2 level 1s and I hang out with Jeff too much.
You're the remedial student. You had to go back and repeat it.
Yeah. What? So to be honest, I took one way back in the day and then I was like skiing professionally doing like park half pipe stuff. And in that time I had several friends who were very, very like knowledgeable in the backcountry who got killed by avalanches. And so I was like, nope, there's no fucking way. Like they are literally so much further beyond me with their education and their awareness in the backcountry. Like I don't have a chance. If they got smoked, yeah, I don't have a chance. Yeah. And so it really wasn't until started hanging out with Jeff and we started talking about Aspect Abbey more and like kind of seeing it from more of a data driven approach and more of a like, hey, rather than put all the focus on how to rescue your friend, which I thought Larry was on like the last podcast. He put it so well. He's like, that should be like CPR. You should have those skills, but that should be the absolute last resort, which is the way I always felt. I was like, I want to know, like, give me the data so I can just like go enjoy myself. And then like, I'm not trying to get super gnarly. Like those days are behind me. But
let's take that CPR analogy for a quick bend right here.
Okay.
How come if I want a guide in the U.S., I have to have a permit, and part of having that permit, I have to have a first aid course and CPR in case somebody's dying on me, but I don't have to actually be trained as a guide to prevent somebody from dying on me.
Yeah.
And I find avalanche education is often the same. People want to play with their sexy beacons and shovels and probes and like, how fast can you find 3 beacons? And I'm like, I don't really care. I'd rather focus on how fast can I make decisions so that I don't need to use my beacon.
Totally.
But the point I was going to make before that, when I was asking about your avalanche education, after you took your second level 1, do you feel like you walked out of there feeling very confident that now you can go ski big lines?
No, absolutely not. And I actually like a huge reason that I'm involved in this project is I feel like, and this is just straight up because I've talked to people my age who say this, they're like, yeah, I take this training and I feel like I like have some sort of qualification now, but when I really dive into it, I don't actually know what's going on.
Totally.
And I feel the exact same way.
Yeah. And I think that's why people continually strive to find more avalanche education. And really the level one course, the goal of the level one course, when ARI sort of started putting these parameters around things and saying, this is what a level one avalanche course is, what they stated at that time, and it still rings true, is that a level one course is a standalone, this is everything you need to know about avalanches. Everything beyond that is like mostly geeky science stuff
that
most people don't need to know. And that led into, you know, the pro track and the rec track split that happened in the last few years in avalanche education, which was definitely needed. but it's not like math, right? If you go, math is very cut and dry. A plus B equals C, no matter what. That's how it is. And so, which is why I kind of like math in high school. I'm like, cool, the answer is the answer. That works for me. But people want the same out of their avalanche education, right? How many times do I hit the shovel before I know that I can go ski this slope? Well, it doesn't work that way. Well, how many degrees above zero is okay before avalanche? Well, it doesn't work that way, right? And so people are continuing to look for that answer. And it's not like math, where if you get an A on the test, you know how to do math, right? It's not totally like if you get an A on your avalanche test, well, you're never going to die in an avalanche. You know, statistically speaking, most people who die in avalanches have avalanche education. So it's not like they weren't aware. But it's just a tricky thing. Like, there's no cut and dry answers. I've seen plenty of avalanches that I go, why? That doesn't make sense to me. Why did that one avalanche and that one didn't? I don't get it. You know, I left Canada, had a real bad season this year. It didn't snow. It got super warm. It rained really high and then it snowed and then it sat. And so that surface snow turned into facets. And then right when I left, it started nuking. Places got like 1 to 2 meters of snow. And that's all sitting on top of, you know, 15 to 30 centimeters of facets on top of a stout crust. And, you know, when we're seeing the weather forecast, everybody's like, oh, great. Now it's finally snowing and the world's going to fall down. Perfect. And I saw this video from a heli ski operation where they were skiing this slope here. And this was the video is from a client with a GoPro on, and they stopped and regrouped. They're in trees, pretty thick, dense trees. Moderate angle, certainly didn't look steep. Guide drops in to ski the next pitch down. And then you see this giant powder cloud on an adjacent slope, right? And it's like, okay, so remote trigger, they triggered it from here and it slid over there. You look at the terrain and there's no huge drastic difference that you would say, oh, I can see why that slid and that didn't. Like, the change was very subtle, slightly more open trees, slightly steeper. But that's after like going back and really deciphering that terrain, you know? So sometimes these differences in what's safe and what isn't are super subtle. And sometimes I'm still baffled by it. Like, I don't know why that slid and that didn't, or I don't know why that didn't slide. I would have thought that that would slide and it didn't. So it just doesn't always make sense in the avalanche world. It's not perfect math by any means.
Yeah. And to be fair, I think we've said it a few times on here, various different guests, but like, there's a lot of, how do you say it, Jeff, where even when you do the wrong thing, sometimes you get away with it. So how are you supposed to, like, how then are you going to know that it was actually the wrong thing to do if you got away with it?
It's a wicked learning environment. We don't get direct feedback. Like if you're playing chess or checkers and Steve and I are playing checkers and I make a bad move, he's going to take my checker. And I'm like, oh, I got feedback and I can learn from that. But like what Steve described, even for the experts, you're like, oh, high danger day. I can't believe that didn't slide. And we just threw 20 pounds of amfo on that and blew the hell out of that slope and it didn't go. How is that possible?
Yeah.
You don't
I got another question for you, Steve. I'm not gonna ask you like what the skiing's like all over the world, but I did wanna you made me think of something, and Jeff, you can chime in on this too. When you go to guide in different places, like you mentioned Iceland and Canada and stuff, obviously those are all gonna have just inherently different snowpacks. Is there a bit of a learning curve or do you have to kind of jump back into a different mindset for each place that you go tour? Like what's the process of that?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, what's interesting, and I get asked this all the time, like, oh, you're from Colorado? You guys have great snow and mountains. Why don't you guide there? And I'm like, well, because the avalanche dragon is real big and nasty in Colorado.
Yeah.
And in Japan, it's like this cute little fur ball that's not so big of a deal.
Totally.
a lot of the places that I've chosen to go, have much less challenging snowpacks than Colorado does. They're not notorious for consistently having persistent weak layers. And when they do pop up, it tends to be much more of a big deal. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, there's a persistent weak layer. And I'm like, oh, that's a cute little thing. It'll probably heal in a couple of days. It'll be all right. It's not like what we see in Colorado where it's like, yep, there's our basal facets. I guess we'll deal with that for the next 5 months.
And then like three more layers of it.
exactly. But yes, there is a learning curve. And I've always tried to schedule myself, both for my own personal wants and desires, that when I show up somewhere, I like to be able to ski for myself personally, go someplace I haven't checked out yet, maybe try, you know, a different mountain range or different place that I haven't seen yet, but it also gives me a time to assimilate to the snowpack and figure out what's going on. And one of the big things we talk about, you know, home or whatever your backyard is you can't just take that snapshot, right? You can't say, hey, I'm going to go, I want to go backcountry skiing next weekend. So on Friday, I'm going to start looking at the avalanche bulletin. It's like, no, you got to watch this thing. You got to track it throughout the season, see what the trends are, see what's happening. Is it improving? Is it degrading? You know, what's happening? So I do the same thing when I'm traveling. I'm getting ready to head to Iceland. What's today? Monday. I guess I leave on Thursday. So we better wrap this up so I can start getting my other important things done before I leave. but I've been like following the weather over there for the past 3 weeks, you know, paying attention to what's going on. I've got some other guide friends who are in the area. There's a guy I know who does avalanche education all over. And this is the second year in a row that he's shown up in Iceland 2 weeks before I do and starts doing this avalanche stuff and starts posting all these videos online. And so I make sure to follow him and pay attention because I'm like, great, he's out there digging pits for me. Like, why wouldn't I watch this stuff and get this information?
Yeah.
So I'm just inferring it all the time, even when I'm not there, to track these trends, see what's going on, so that when I show up, I'm not just like completely in the dark. It's kind of the same tactic as here, right? Like you got to pay attention all the time. And if you're going to a bunch of different places, you got to pay attention. Even if I'm going to go down to the San Juans in Colorado, if I know I have a hut trip coming up down there, I got to start paying attention to what's happening down there.
Totally. Yeah, I've just made a point now of every morning when I wake up, instead of getting on Instagram, it's like the first thing I look at is Aspect Avid and see like what's going on and just like try to make that the morning habit to keep track of like over the time.
Yeah, and it's nice to have that sort of one-stop shop clearinghouse like Aspect Avi, where you can be like, okay, I just need to look at this one thing. I don't have to look at, you know, an avalanche bulletin and a weather site and this thing and that thing. It's like, I can just look at one resource that tells me the majority of what I want to know. It's nice to have that in your pocket.
Highly aggregated.
Totally. Whatever that means. Yeah, I like it better when it puts all the pieces together for me.
That's right. Jeff, do you got anything else you want to talk to your brother about?
What kind of mood you're in before you cut my hair? Because sometimes you're a little salty and it gets, I just feel like it's retribution for our childhood squabbles. And like, I don't know how the hair is going to come out, and you're a little bit rough, and it's this constant like verbal diarrhea of how it's not going well. And, oh geez, I don't know about this. Maybe we should just shave it all off and you should go for the bald look.
You know what I think it comes down to is how many times in the past week you've bugged me about cutting your hair. So you might want to take that into consideration.
It's getting like the wings are coming out. It's like flaps down.
I understand. Sounds like I should come over and film this. Get rid of the wings. Take it all off. I got it. No problem.
I do have one question.
I think it's time for Jeff to do like a proper business mullet.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So Steve, both you and I share a very healthy appreciation of the absurd, and we often people give us feedback and say, hey, I can't tell if you're kidding or not. And we're like, oh, sorry, I'm kidding most of the time. I imagine there's going to be a bunch of students in the AMGA who are going to watch this to try to get insights in how to manage you as their examiner on their next exam or course. You got anything you want to say to those students out there who are trying to game the system and get an edge?
In regards to how they should deal with me, or in regards to how they should deal with their guiding education?
Do both.
I think the most important thing, and what I really try to do, and I don't know how I've gotten this reputation as being a tough examiner or a tough instructor. Like, I'm a freaking teddy bear.
I'm a fucking teddy bear.
Don't you forget it. Chill. But a lot of people have said after the course that they're like, oh, wow, like working with you is actually really awesome. But I think the most important thing, and I wish somebody had told me this before, is that on your guide exams, that's when you need to prove what it is that you can do. On your courses leading up to it, you're there to learn. Everything's educational. Make mistakes. That's fine. Don't kill anybody, but you can make mistakes. Ask questions, ask for clarification, try things that you don't know how to do. If you know how to do these two things and you just keep showing me those two things repeatedly, I'm going to be like, yeah, great. You know how to do those two things. That's awesome. Can you do these other seven things? I don't know. So I always encourage people, like, try to take that pressure off of you. Yeah. And let us try to impart more knowledge. Don't try to show me the thing you already know how to do. Try to show me that you want to learn how to do other things.
I think it's there's a real succinct quote that says, are you worried about being right or getting it right?
Yeah. That's a good one. And it's tough, you know, a lot of these, you know, whatever outdoor pursuit, mountain climbing, rock climbing, backcountry skiing, they are centered around somewhat of proving yourself socially more now with social media and everything, but also internally, right? Like, I think I've finally gotten to the point where I'm pretty comfortable with the climbing grades that I can handle. I'm not like, I need to be better. I've got to push harder.
Right? I'm comfortable being mediocre.
Well, and how long, Jeff, how long did we spend always trying to do things faster than we did before, right? Hey, let's do this. You know, last time this tour took us 4 hours. Let's see if we can do it in three. And I'm like, who cares? You know, it's a sunny day. I'd rather be out here all day.
Yeah, big mind shift. Yeah.
I think one thing it's really hard to set that aside in your guide trainings and be like, yeah, it doesn't matter if I can, you know, prove that I can do this one thing or to show how slick I can be, like try something new, do something different.
I think one thing I try to impart on students is like, hey, listen, for my first couple courses, I was literally the worst person in the class. And it's okay. It's not where you start, it's where you finish. And like, how do you integrate the feedback that you get on your course? And how can you be better prepared coming in so that you're like, I've gone through the student handbook and I know I'm proficient in all these things. And then the instructors are going to polish it up and help me work on the application and the terrain, as opposed to how do I tie a munter mule? Oh, shoot. I guess I should have practiced that before I showed up.
Yeah. And it's not different than what we were talking about with avalanche education. Like a lot of people see it as I need to jump through the hoop. What do I have to do to get through the hoop? Rather than, you know, how can I better understand the hoop? I need to understand the entire being of the hoop. I see it. I follow these. I'm not real sure why. There's always interesting things on there. But, I'm on these Facebook forums for like backcountry skiing in Colorado and stuff. And you'll see these posts from people who are like, hey, I've got next Thursday off and I want to go up to Berthoud. I got a level one. Anybody want to go? And people will be chiming in like, yeah, I got my level one too. Let's go. And I'm just like, holy crap. Like, these people understand the hoop or did they jump through the hoop? I'm not going to choose my backcountry partner by who's free on Thursday. But I think that's, I would say that's a positive change that I think I've seen in the last few years. Early on in the middle of my avalanche education teaching career, you could definitely tell the people that were there to jump the hoop. You know, they think that if they just sleep in the back of the class, somehow they're going to get the knowledge that they need and everything will be fine. And I think now I tend to see people who are more inquisitive and they do want to know more and they do want to try to understand more. And then I think they often leave the class being frustrated because they're like, okay, you taught me a bunch of things, but I still don't know the answer. And that's, it's the imperfect math. There is no answer. I'm sorry. I can't tell you that.
It doesn't really teach you answers. It teaches you like how to ask the right questions.
Yeah. Yep. Hugely. Yep. And the more questions you're asking should give you the answer that you don't know the answer.
True. That's funny. Oh man, I had something good I wanted to ask you as like a wrap up, but now I lost me. I was just listening to that.
Yeah. Sorry to distract you.
Well, no, it was good. That was a good point you made. I know what I was gonna say. It sounds like just from hanging out with Jeff a lot and just now having conversations with a bunch of mountain guides, which has been really cool for me. It seems like the more sort of data you guys all get and the more of these like close calls and crazy stories you have, it really changes your sort of fundamental understanding of what it means to like play in the backcountry. So maybe as like a wrap up or a final thought, like what do you think would be a great, maybe like reminder or just like mentality to put people in like to think about before they go into the backcountry, like no matter what level they have?
Well, there's kind of the classic that we always say in avalanche education is that you have goals and objectives. Your goal is to go out and have fun and come home safe at the end of the day. Your objective is the thing that you want to ride when you're out there, but your objective shouldn't change your goal. Your goal is always to come home safe, right? I would assume that's true for most people. Maybe some people have a different opinion of what that ultimate goal is. So there is that, to think about what you're doing. And as I've let that formulate my experiences through the years, do I still like skiing the steep and deep? Heck yeah, absolutely. Is there times when I want to go and get rowdy? Heck yeah, for sure. But those times have to present themselves to you. You can't just take it when you want it. And I've learned that the hard way. I've had plenty of close calls and been like, oh yeah, okay, I can see where my decision-making was clouded by me wanting to ski this line on this day in these conditions or with this person or whatever it is. But now I'm much more in favor of, I want to go out and have an enjoyable experience and I want to have a good time. I want to make sure that my team comes back safe, and that we don't have to do any CPR out there and that we don't have to pull our beacons out. Shouldn't have to do that. And I still have, you know, I love talent. Students are often blown away by this, especially around Crested Butte, where they assume that I've skied everything. And I'm like, nah, man, I still have a tick list, even in my backyard, of things that I haven't skied because it hasn't lined up with the timing, the conditions, the right partner, you know, all these things that have to fall into place. Sometimes it just doesn't happen. And so I haven't been able to go out and ski these things. And, you know, maybe I'll get to them and maybe I won't. That's fine. But I can't go try to jam it in on a day when it's not appropriate to be doing that.
Wise words. I like that. You really got to wait for the opportunity. You can't create it.
Correct. Yep.
Hey, so Steve, you've been in the mountains now for about 30 years and guiding for most of that. And you're a senior instructor and examiner for the AMGA. And you work with mountain teams from special ops and run heli operations internationally. If people want to train with you and bring their level up, you're really top-notch coach. How do they get a hold of you?
No, they can probably not find me on social media. they could check out my website that I updated, I think, sometime during the pandemic. Email, my website is stevebanksmountainguide.com. Yep. My email is steve@stevebanksmountainguide.com. So they can find me through either one of those avenues, although Facebook Messenger and Instagram DMs do work. But it might be slower to respond on those.
All right. So try to
we'll throw all your info down below.
All right. Thanks a lot. And really appreciate you coming on and sharing your experiences with us. And I'm really looking forward to my haircut with Stefano Banco, my Italian stylist.
We'll see how that works out for you.
Hey, Steve. Thanks so much, man. It was great talking to you.
All right. Good chatting with you guys. Take care.
Bye. Take it easy, guys.
Thank you so much for listening to All Aspects. If you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating and review. It really is the best way to help others find the show. Thanks again to our business daddy, Aspect Abbey, for making this show possible. To learn more about how Aspect Abbey is making avalanche safety simple, go to aspectabbey.com. If you want to use this powerful new tool on your next backcountry adventure, simply download the app from the App Store and enjoy 30 days free on them. Lastly, special thanks to Ice Lab for helping us produce this show. You guys rock and we couldn't do it without you. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the backcountry.